The sun is beaming down. It feels like it's 90 degrees out. So everyone's, I mean, I need to put like sunscreen on. It doesn't feel like winter.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else? The Iditarod and dog mushing. And sometimes it's sunny, but sometimes it's not. Things are not always rosy, my friends. There's good, bad, ugly, everything in between. Anyway, I'm your host, Casey Grove, joined once again by Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon. Hi, Tegan.
Hey, Casey.
All right, well, before we get too cooked, how about a word from our sponsor? Lowered expectations. First, it's been a couple days since we were last here on the Iditapod. Again, we're not doing daily episodes this time around due to some constraints, but we would like to catch you up. And we've had two recent scratches. There was one basically before the race even started, just hours before the race started, but two really recent ones. One is Cindy Galley, who had a really tough time getting to the race to begin with. She's out with an illness. We'll talk more about that. Also, we are sad to say that Two Rivers musher Allie Zirkel has also scratched. It seems that she took a spill and maybe has concussed herself and has some upper body injuries. We're going to talk a little bit more about that as far as what we know about it anyway, but pretty bummed out to hear that Allie Zirkel has scratched due to an injury from what she has said will be her last Iditarod. And we are also going to be joined by former Alaska Public Media reporter Zachariah Hughes, co-founder of the Iditapod, currently on assignment for the Anchorage Daily News. He right now is in McGrath. We're going to talk to him. But first, Tegan, you went to the race start. We usually would call this the race restart, but there wasn't a ceremonial start in Anchorage, so this was just the actual start of the race. Can you paint a picture for me of what it looked like there in Deschke Landing? What was it like there at the start on Sunday?
It was sunny. It was warm. There was a lot of dogs barking. But other than the dogs, it was pretty quiet. The race had really tight restrictions on who could be near the starting line because of COVID-19 as part of their list of precautions. I ran into Ryan Olson pretty early on. She's one of this year's mushers from Two Rivers. And here's how she explained what the day looked like.
So first thing, when you arrived, they came and did a swab, and they didn't want you to be milling about until you'd gotten the results. So I was negative, yay, passed another test. So we've got one more in McGrath, and then we should be all clear.
When I talked to Olson, she was just hanging by her sled. She had sunglasses on, a face mask, and was just kind of basking in the sun. It was really, you know, one of those clear, sunny, beautiful Alaska winter days where it's, you know, temperatures are in the 20s, but you feel like you should be in shorts. Olson was saying that she felt extra relaxed on Sunday because there weren't many events in the lead up to the race, no in-person events at least. So she said, you know, it felt exceptionally chill this year.
Pretty wonderful for me as a musher to not have to do the ceremonial start and the banquet, and especially because, yeah, that's for being like an introvert that prefers to live out in the middle of nowhere when you're all of a sudden thrown into downtown Anchorage with a bunch of spectators. It's, yeah, can be kind of stressful. So it was nice to not have to do that this year.
So, yeah, I guess I would say, you know, the themes of Sunday were mushers said they felt pretty relaxed. They were happy to be there. I walked by Pete Kaiser from Bethel, the 2019 Iditarod champion, and he was eating a Subway sandwich by his dog truck. We talked a little bit about the race and training, and I was asking him, since this is his 12th Iditarod start, if he had any routine or anything he liked to do, you know, in the hours leading up to the race start, and here's what he said.
We've stopped at the same Holiday gas station to get coffee and gas up and some other stuff every year for, this will be the 12th year in a row now, so I don't think we've ever not stopped at that same gas station coming out here. So that's about it. There's no real superstition behind it. It just happens to be the most convenient one. And now it's kind of a joke. So we make sure we stop there every year.
Yeah, Pete Kaiser, maybe one of the most laid back of all mushers. But really, like, what is a tradition if not something that you do every year for whatever reason? It's nice to hear he stops to get his coffee at the same place every time he's starting the Iditarod. So that's Pete Kaiser. Who else did you talk to, Tegan?
So a little farther down in this parking lot area, I talked to Wade Mars. And I guess just to zoom out a little bit, the Mushers all have their dog trucks parked in this just basically a big parking lot right near the starting line. So in the hours before 2 p.m. when the race started, they're all just, you know, kind of sitting near their dog trucks, unloading their dogs, putting them on a line that kind of surrounds the truck area. Wade Mars, he was also just sitting on his sled talking with some people. And he was mentioning how he's, you know, readying for some new challenges this year, like crossing the Alaska Range twice on this out and back loop. But he says he's also ready for, you know, sort of the same old annual hurdles like sleep deprivation. He said he thought he might have a little more practice this year because he is the dad of a 3-month-old.
You know, training dogs already makes me pretty sleep deprived, and then a baby on top of it, I get woken up a lot more at night. I'm just hoping I don't oversleep waiting for the baby to cry or something.
So I guess to summarize the scene at the race starting line, it's sunny, it's pretty warm, it's pretty empty, there's face masks, there's COVID-19 testing, and mushers are just hanging out, checking their sled bags one more time, eating some lunch, checking over their dogs. And then at 2 p.m. on the dot, Aaron Peck takes off. He's the first musher on the trail.
Good luck to Aaron Peck from Grand Prairie, Canada.
Five, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
And there's our first musher on the trail, Aaron Peck from Canada. Good luck, Aaron. Next in the chute, please welcome bib number 3.
And so I'm standing there watching the mushers, recording the sound, and then all of a sudden someone working for the Iditarod asks if I want to go get photos from a different spot. I'm like, sure, why not? Sounds good. And so we begin this journey on a big arc walking around the side of the starting area. We climb over a little plastic gate, and then we climb through this wooden gate on the other side. You know, the snow is thigh deep. I'm dragging this 5-foot microphone pole, trying to socially distance for interviews, tangled in these wires. And I don't know, 200 feet beyond that, there's... there's people cheering. There's a makeshift tiki bar. There's signs. There's bullhorns. There's a lot of kids, some very excited about this giant microphone I have dragged over, and also very excited to talk about dogs.
It's just really pretty, and it has a magical feeling to it. Because all of the dogs. I actually have 2 dogs at home. Because it's too cold for them up here. I have a pug that's a puppy.
All right, Jessie!
Yeah, she's only a couple months old. Go, and then there's my dog, Chaos. She is 4, and so she's 4, but in doggy years, she's 28.
That's Kennedy. She was there with a group of kids and adults, including local lodge owner Cindy Height.
Beautiful weather, great friends, closing my business down and having a good old time for a few hours.
Anyway, so it was quite the scene, just a, you know, stone's throw away from the starting line, a couple hundred people, snow machines zooming in circles. But it was just such a contrast to be, you know, standing at like the official starting line where it's really regulated. There's lots of rules. Everyone had to get their COVID test, you know, a couple hundred feet away, walk through some trees, through some fences, and there's what feels like a whole different scene.
Yeah, the whole thing seems very different, and it sounds like it looked very different. And I mean, we've talked about this a little bit already, this whole changed course and just all these different restrictions and the fact that they're going to be maybe outside of checkpoints and not going into communities as much or at all makes me wonder, are the mushers themselves, to get back to them, what different things are they carrying this year, whether it's equipment or sort of symbolic things that mushers might be carrying?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's definitely some different equipment being brought by some mushers on the trail. Talked to a few who are bringing pop-up tents for the first time because of the nature of the route and the checkpoints, since mushers won't be going into school buildings or community areas as much. Some mushers also said they were bringing extra clothes because of less heated indoor space on the trail to, you know, hang up dry out gear. Pete Kaiser and Wade Mars both said they were bringing sleeping pads, also just expecting to be sleeping in tents or outside more often. And then to get to other things outside of equipment, there's Larry Doherty.
I will be carrying some COVID-19 vials that have been used, and but there's no risk that we'll lose or waste any COVID vaccine out there.
So Larry is a doctor in Anchorage and is bringing COVID-19 vaccine vials on the trail. He says he'll pass them off to the mayor of Shagaluk, who's meeting him at the Iditarod checkpoint close to this year's turnaround point. And, you know, he underscored there's no vaccine in the vials, but said it's all kind of symbolic.
But as a physician and, you know, as someone who has really a lot of hope for what this vaccine means for us, you know, I hope that folks can latch on to this vision and this message, and if they are fortunate to be offered the vaccine, that maybe they'll give that a very close look.
So certainly a really unique, very 2021 item in Larry Doherty's sled this year, the vaccine, hoping to raise awareness of the COVID-19 vaccine in the state.
And he's made this connection, which I'm sure a lot of other people have, to the 1925 serum run, which, of course, was a dog sled relay of diphtheria antitoxin that went from Nenana in interior Alaska, and that's where the railroad ended, all the way to Nome. And to just recap that as quickly as I can, it's a huge story, but basically what happened was there was this diphtheria outbreak in Nome, and diphtheria, not unlike COVID, is a respiratory illness, and it can kill you. Diphtheria, though, is caused by a bacteria, not a virus like COVID-19. But certainly people have made this connection to what we're going through now and the vaccines getting out and this diphtheria serum, which is like an antitoxin that just kills that bacteria. And like a lot of illnesses, it's especially bad for children. That was like the huge worry there in Nome, was that a lot of kids could die and potentially everyone in town because it's so contagious, and it was really starting to take off. It was actually starting to take off in December of 1924, but then by January of 1925, this is just a little while after the last ship had left and the port was being iced in because it's Nome, it's in the Arctic, and kids were actually starting to die. And this doctor in Nome, Curtis Welch, the only doctor in Nome, saw that diphtheria was spreading quickly in the community. He sent out this urgent telegram for serum. The problem was, again, this was 100 years ago, basically, and flying a plane to Nome wasn't the best option. The planes at the time were not up to that task. The port was iced in, so what do you do? Well, dog mushing had been a mode of transportation in Alaska for, you know, hundreds of years, and a plan came together that included the best dog mushers in the towns and villages between Nenana and Nome. And unlike the first couple of COVID-19 vaccines that we've seen, which need to be stored at very, very low temperatures, this diphtheria serum had to be kept warm. People sort of described this thing holding the serum as like a crock pot looking thing. So like as if you were going to show up at a potluck with, you know, your moose chili that you made or something. And long story short, it worked. They had some really good dogs pulling them, and they mushed through rough conditions and storms and delivered this serum to Nome and probably saved the entire town, or at least like a huge chunk of the population. At the time, this was huge news around the whole world. Stories about the serum run put dog mushing in Alaska into the minds of people all over the globe. Just a quick side note, back in 2015, I was covering the Iditarod, and I had this amazing opportunity to talk to some descendants of a couple of the serum run mushers. That year, the Iditarod had been rerouted through some interior Alaska villages, Tanana, Huslia, Koyukuk. And in Tanana, we actually had a chance to talk to Roy Folger. He was 89 at the time. And he's actually like the son of two serum runners. His dad was Johnny Folger, And another Tanana resident, Sam Joseph, adopted Ray Folger after Johnny died and Roy was 5 years old. Anyway, he told me that both of those guys were his heroes growing up. And I would assume for many people in that region that these guys were like the superheroes of the time. And then this other guy who had ties to Galena, Edgar Nolner, was the 10th leg, and that was from Whiskey Creek to Galena. And I think maybe the most special part of covering the 2015 race for me was getting a chance to talk to Edgar Nolner's daughter, Josephine Roberts. She was 93 at the time. She actually passed away in 2019. And she was just a couple years old when the Serum Run happened. And when we were there in Tanana, she invited us into her home. She was like stoking the fire and offering us coffee. And we actually got to talk for quite a long time. She had some memory problems. And again, I mean, she was very young, so I don't think she actually remembered exactly what happened during the Serum Run, but she heard the stories for her entire life. And it was just an amazing thing to talk to her and make this direct connection to literally like almost 100 years into the past. But she said that all of her brothers mush dogs, and she said, quote, they were all tall, nice-looking guys. So that's what she remembered about it.
Wow, that's amazing that you got to talk to her.
It really, you know, was an amazing experience, and they still make that connection all the way back to the past. I mean, they saw this for themselves before snow machines came around. Like, dog mushing was the thing. That's what you did. That's how you got your firewood. That's how you, you know, got your fish back from fish camp. It's part of the reason why you had to go fishing. Feeding your dogs, like you're gassing up your car every day. Anyway, there's a lot more to say about the Serum Run, but certainly folks have made that connection to that major epidemic there in Nome, to the pandemic that we are still living through right now. And, you know, just an epic, epic journey, quite a journey across Alaska. To make a hard turn into something more recent, we wanted to recap another epic journey that occurred from before the race started, and that is with Cindy Galley. And Tegan, I wonder, can you catch us up on what happened with Cindy Galley?
Yeah, so Cindy is from Minnesota. She said she was training her sled dog team in Montana, and then she had to get up to Alaska for the Iditarod, and she's run this race many times before. But this year she had to, you know, cross the Canadian border during the pandemic, and there's really tight restrictions to get across to Canada. And here's what she said about trying to cross the border this year.
We got tested right before we went to the border because they wanted testing within, I think it was 72 hours. So we got tested before we went to the border, and then we got to the border, and after about a 3-hour process, they told us that they wouldn't let us by, they wouldn't let us pass. So we got turned around.
Cindy's talking there at the Iditarod race start, so you can hear the trucks and the dogs in the background. But anyway, so as Cindy said, they got turned around at the border. And then here's what happened next.
At my son's suggestion, I checked into flying everything up, and Alaska Airlines ended up giving us a reasonable deal, and other, you know, like my former vet in Montana quickly did all the health certificates for the dogs, and we drove from Montana to Seattle and flew everything up.
And Cindy said that all was made possible because of this local community fundraising effort to help pay for those last minute flights up to Alaska. And this was also all like unfolding pretty recently. Cindy and her dog team landed just 4 days or so before the race start. And so, you know, talked to Cindy about that at Deshka Landing soon before she left. And then an unfortunate part of the story, after she left the starting line, Cindy actually ended up scratching from the race. She dropped out about 80 miles into the competition. Race officials said that Cindy was sick and that her illness was not related to COVID-19.
There's kind of some luck built into it. There's a certain amount of training and preparation that you can do, a lot, obviously, to be able to get to this point. But sometimes it can even come down to just one thing happens. You take a spill and your race is over. And it sounds like that's what happened with Allie Zirkle. What do we know about what led to her scratch?
Yeah, and that was the most recent big news from the trail was Ali Zirkle, iconic Iditarod musher, had dropped out of the Iditarod at Roan, which is this super remote checkpoint about 200 miles from the starting line. Race officials said Zirkle suffered a significant impact, was the term they used. And they said she got a concussion plus other injuries to her upper torso. So we're not totally sure what exactly happened out on the trail. The Alaska Air National Guard actually ended up going out to the Roan checkpoint to helicopter Zirkle to an Anchorage hospital. The guard said that Zirkle suffered a fall. And what we do know about that stretch of trail between Rainy Pass and Roan, it's about 35 miles, so it's not super long, but it's really treacherous. It's like notoriously tough terrain. That's where the Dalzell Gorge is. It's windy, it's steep, and it certainly led to problems for mushers before.
And what's really going to be sad about this for a lot of people is that Ali had announced her retirement before this race, saying that this Iditarod was going to be her last. We know her as a perennial top 10 finisher. She took second place 3 years in a row. People were really hoping that she was maybe going to be the next woman champion of the Iditarod. And here, in what looks like it's going to be her last Iditarod, at least that's what she says, that she's had to scratch. The latest that we do know is that she's been released from the hospital and is reportedly in stable condition and with her family. So that's good to hear. But you talked to her before the race about this retirement plan. What did she tell you about that?
I did. Yeah, Ali, about a month before the race started, posted a retirement letter on her kennel's website. And, you know, Ali has been at the starting line every year since 2001. And she's an Iditarod icon at this point, brings huge crowds of fans to the race. But Zirkle said, talking to her on the phone after she posted that retirement letter, that the Iditarod is a really hard race. She always wants to give it 100%. She wants to try to win it every year, and she was going to give it her all one more time and then retire.
It's challenging. It's physically and mentally challenging. And so I really have given my best shot, and that's what I want to do. I want to do that one more time, give it my best shot to win, and then I don't want to run Iditarod for fun and for the adventure and enjoyment. That's not anything I've really done. I can play with my ducks here at home and do that. So I know what it takes to win. And in the next few years, old Ali Z ain't going to have it. So I might as well hang it up before I don't have it anymore.
She sounds so sad there.
I know. And, you know, she kind of moved between sort of some sadness on that phone call, but she also seemed really like hopeful for the future for her and her husband, Alan Moore, who's also a musher and who has also retired. She got pretty excited when she talked about, you know, what her and Alan might be able to do in this next chapter of their lives as they just kind of get out of race mode.
I have absolutely loved it for 20 years. And I mean, especially the Alaskan community. I mean, that's probably what I'm going to miss the most is, you know, mushing through the little village of Golovin and having people hand me a cup of hot coffee and say, Ali, we love you. Like, I mean, that's what I'm going to miss. But in the same sense, like, it's time for me to, I can't say chill out because I'll probably warm up, but it's time for me to just kind of tame it down a notch and not go 100 miles an hour all the time. And my nephew jokes with me all the time because I'm always in race mode. I never slow down. I go to pick him up in the morning and he's like, okay, calm down. And I'm like, we're in race mode. And he's like, you know, someday you're not going to be in race mode. And so I guess that's what I'm going for.
Ali had said at the end of the call that she didn't know what exactly her and Alan might do next. She said they'll definitely still have dogs. And she said it could be as simple as, you know, just sitting down and enjoying a cup of coffee and reflecting on their lives instead of constantly being in that go, go, go mode. So, yeah, it sounded like Ali was like, you know, I can't invest 100% in this for much longer, so I'm not going to do it for fun. I'm going to retire. And it's unfortunate that this final race for her ended like it did.
Yeah, for sure. Like many things in life, the only constant seems to be change, really. But one thing that has not changed not yet at least, is Zachariah Hughes out on the Iditarod Trail still covering the race. And we're going to bring in former Alaska Public Media reporter Zachariah Hughes, who's on assignment for the Anchorage Daily News. Zach, where are you right now?
Hello, Casey. Hello, Tegan. I am sitting in a hotel room in McGrath.
And where have you been?
I left Birchwood on Monday with Pilot Rob, and we flew to Finger Lakes, hopped up the Alaska Range to the Rainy Pass checkpoint on Puntilla Lake, and spent a lot of the afternoon there. Then flew through Rainy Pass itself, kind of tracing the Dalzell Creek that drains through there. A lot of open water there this year. Spotted some ice bridges from the air, but a lot of water crossings, it looked like. And then we set down on the Tatina River, which is just outside of the Roan checkpoint, and spent a little bit of time there. There were just a few of the front of pack mushers there. And in the evening, 4 or 5, we took off and made it to McGrath. And I've been here ever since.
All right. So what are the mushers telling you? I mean, from those first couple stops, how are things looking out on the trail?
By all accounts, it's a great trail. Really fast, as good as a lot of people remember it. Wade Mars told me in Rainy Pass that the ride in was the best he'd ever remembered. And hearing that a lot, I think you see in a lot of the times people are posting that it's just overall a faster race. People are really going. It's a shortened race. I mean, that reroute knocked, you know, more than 100 miles off the total, and people are really recalibrating their run rests to accommodate that. You don't have to pace yourself for the full 1,000 miles you normally would. And even though it's still a very long race, there is a little bit of an effect that's having on where people are stopping and how they're taking their rest.
Zach, I'm curious, you know, we know, I guess, from Anchorage that the race has changed significantly because of the coronavirus pandemic, but what are you seeing at checkpoints? Like, what looks different this year?
Well, it's masks, particularly among the race-affiliated folks. I mean, veterinarians, race judges are masked. You know, there were some spectators out at Rainy Pass that had kind of come out to look. Not like a normal year where you'd see these kind of large kind of planes filled with people. I mean, these were all really small planes. And some people that were out there kind of, you know, there's a hunting party that got a bison a few days ago and, you know, was milling about, stopping by. But for the most part, places where there's usually a few dozen people this year, there's just a lot less of that, a lot less spectators, a lot less people kind of following along on snow machines. It really does feel quite scaled back. And then the checkpoints themselves are, you know, a lot of the early places in the race are bare bones to begin with. And this year, it's even more so. So the mushers are exactly the same. I mean, it's kind of nice how familiar it is to see mushers just strawing their dogs and cooking and kind of away from people, that the racers and the competition really doesn't look different. It's all of the tertiary activity that feels modified.
That's interesting. And I was curious, Zach, you know, you mentioned that the trail's been pretty good so far. It seems like largely uneventful, except, you know, the recent news that Allie Zirkle has dropped out. And speaking of that news, you know, she dropped out on that like notoriously treacherous stretch of trail between Rainy Pass and Roan, where you have the Dalzell Gorge, before that, the Happy River Steps. And I was wondering, like, what have you heard from mushers about those typically really hard stretches of trail? What does the gorge look like this year? What do the Happy River Steps look like this year?
So there's been a ton of wind in that area. And I was, even when we were flying it, I was talking with my pilot, you know, like, oh, why is the snow so shiny? Is it, was there a melt and a refreeze? And he used a term I'd never heard before. He said, oh, it's just real wind thrashed. And I guess the wind has just scoured huge sections of that pass to be real polished down. So, you know, I don't know how fast that's making. I don't know how slick, but for sure it's not big, puffy, fluffy snow. It's pretty kind of scoured down. Yeah. So for the most part, just kind of great trail conditions, but it the diciest part looked to be ascending up to the pass itself after the Rainy Pass checkpoint. And I will say that same kind of scouring wind really looks like it's done a number on the section heading out of Roan. So the Tatina River as it kind of leads out towards, you know, the Buffalo tunnels. A lot of that section of trail looked like there was really thin snow cover, and the trail was just like a, you know, a brown ribbon etched in between really thin looking snow. So it'll be interesting to hear from mushers how that run to Nikolai was, because that looked like it was a not a hard, fast trail exactly in some of those sections heading towards Nikolai.
Have you heard any weird or wacky stories from the mushers so far?
I have not heard a single weird or wacky thing. I mean, I have to say, it's like this in a normal year, but there's a lot of mushers just like napping out with their dogs. And I don't know if I'm seeing more of it because, you know, they don't want to go into checkpoints, or if it's just like I'm looking for it and so I'm seeing it more. But just a lot of sweet vignettes of just mushers curled up in sleeping bags, nestled in with their dogs on piles of straw. Or I took a photo yesterday of like Pete Kaiser just laying on a sleeping pad under his parka with his mukluks kind of pointed towards the mountains and his dogs all laid out nice and orderly. So just a lot of like sweet napping vignettes. That's the weirdest or wackiest thing I've seen so far. So pretty benign.
It's not weird or wacky, but it is kind of cute. So thank you for sharing.
I would say the weirdest, wackiest thing was Pilot Rob taking it upon himself to climb on the roof and clear snow off of the internet satellite.
What a guy. That's amazing.
Zach, did you pack differently for the trail this year? Since I imagine accommodations are different. Like, do you have to bring more food, or what are you, bringing a tent? What are you doing?
I always overpack on stuff. And this year I'm feeling really dumb for bringing, like, I brought a lot of food, a lot of snacks, but we're staying in a hotel where they literally cook you a hot breakfast and a hot dinner every night. So yeah, that was really dumb. You know, not to have, but there's really not a lot of incentive to stuff handfuls of like dried peanuts and trail mix into your craw if you know, like, oh, if I just wait, I'll get to eat chicken pasta or whatever is on the menu. I did bring a lot more because I knew we were going to be set up in one place. I brought a lot more seltzer water. So I've broken into my bubblies, and Pilot Rob enjoys them as well, which is good because nice. You got to share with Pilot Rob. Yeah, I mean, just a lot less sort of like backup clothing, since, you know, I don't have to totally like live out of a backpack this year. For the first time ever, Tegan, you'll appreciate this a lot. For the first time ever, I unpacked my clothes and put them in a dresser. Like, my shirts are in a drawer. My, you know, silken cardigans that I wear at the end of a long day, those are in a drawer. So that feels very different. I don't know why it's such a big thing to not have to like rummage, but have things laid out.
Well, I think we're going to have to cut it short there. And thanks for being here, Zach, to update us from McGrath, former Alaska public media reporter Zachariah Hughes on assignment for the Anchorage Daily News. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Zach.
I just want to add, I miss you both as colleagues and as friends, and it is very different. And I hope you're still having fun even without me. Even though I know that's impossible.
Well, we miss you too, Zach. And I mean, the one thing I'm afraid of is that we're going to do snack attack with Zach, and you're going to be eating like a filet mignon or something. You know?
I think like prime beef is on the menu tonight.
Of course
at
it is.
Hotel. Okay, I'm going to hang up.
Bye. Thanks. Good luck.
Bye.
Okay, well, now that we've caught up with Zach, it's time to talk about the race. Tegan, can you catch us up on the race itself, the actual, you know, sled dog race?
So we've seen teams really moving down the trail this year. It seems like people are going pretty quickly. It's still so early on in the race. Looking at the race tracker now, we've got a handful of the front runners on the trail into McGrath, which is where Zach is, near mile 300 of this 850-mile race trail. Right now, Dallas Seavey is leading the pack. He's followed by Richie Deal, Pete Kaiser, Yor Olsom, Travis Beals, Brent Sass, Ryan Reddington, Wade Mars, Nick Petit, Paige Drobny. There haven't been a ton of surprises so far in terms of who's running at the front of the pack, but it's still so early. So we'll see what it looks like after mushers start taking their mandatory breaks.
Yeah, we say this every year. I mean, really, it isn't until mushers take that 24-hour mandatory break that's kind of really where you get more of a sense of who's actually in the lead or what the positioning is. It's also when you come off your 24, that's where the race differential, like you mentioned earlier, the mushers took off out of Willow at 2-minute intervals. And so that's got to be accounted for at some point later in the race. And that's during the 24. So really that's when you get a good idea of who's where in the race. And again, you know, the podcast, we're not rolling these out on a daily basis, but we do have stories and photos and all kinds of other stuff on our website. It's alaskapublic.org or alaskapublic.org/Iditarod specifically to find the Iditarod content. One thing that we have done every year, as far as I know, with the Iditapod is have listener questions come in. And so today we actually have our first listener question. It comes to us from Lincoln Kelly in Waco, Texas.
I have wondered what is the most technical part of the trail? Is it the burn? Is it Rainy Pass? Is it Happy Canyons or the Buffalo Tunnels? Love your show. I've listened to all of the episodes. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Meredith Mapes. I am an Iditarod musher from Kinnick, Alaska. I ran the Iditarod in 2018 and finished in 49th place. And I ran the Iditarod in 2020 and I scratched in Unalakleet. And I think the most difficult part of the trail, the most technical part of the trail, depends on the snow years. But for me, it would definitely be the Dalzell Gorge. I consider myself to be a fairly above average sled driver. I've been running sled dogs for over 20 years now, so it's pretty rare that I tip a sled or anything like that. And in 2018 in the Dalzell Gorge, it was a good snow year, and I managed to tip my sled countless times. I literally lost count of how many times I tipped over and dragged behind my dog sled going down the gorge. And in 2020, I actually only tipped over once. It was another good snow year, luckily. And the one time that I did tip over, I tipped over and barrel rolled down an embankment, and another musher had to help me get my sled upright and back onto the trail. So I think the gorge for me is definitely the most technical part of the trail.
All right. Well, an answer straight from an Iditarod musher. Good job getting that, Tegan. And when she's talking about good snow years, it's like soft snow would be a good thing to have there. What we heard from Zach is it sounds like it's not the case at the Dalzell Gorge and leading into it this year, kind of speculating, but thinking maybe that Allie maybe had taken a spill in that section on some ice or some windblown crust or whatever is going on there. But yeah, I mean, I feel like that is an answer that a lot of Iditarod mushers would give talking about that section. And a good question, too. I mean, there's a lot of technical, difficult sections of trail. It's, you know, it's usually 1,000 miles. This year, it's more like 850. But there's a lot to deal with in there. We really appreciate the question, Lincoln. And if you have a question about the Iditarod or dog mushing in general, we would love to hear from you. The best way to do that is to record a voice memo. Most phones have this built-in app that you can do that with. Tell us your name. Tell us where you're from. Ask your question. You might actually hear yourself on the Iditapod. Send that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Again, that's iditarod@alaskapublic.org. And we will try to answer your question. For today, though, that's about all the time that we have. This is a production of Alaska Public Media. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm your host, Casey Grove.
And I'm Tegan Hanlon.
And until next time, happy trails.
Coming down, Yor, and he is 41, he's from Norway, and he's won the Iditarod. Yor! Yeah!